Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about a lot of the implications technology has for government, for protest movements, for private citizens, and some of the consequences we could all be facing, as well as the failure of Democrats to take any responsibility for this year's election results, which weren't that great for them. But before we can move on, while you were most likely sleeping, a massive new government surveillance provision took effect on midnight Wednesday. I guess you could say Thursday. The benignly named Rule 41 passed into law after a last-second effort by some senators led by Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden failed. As is often the case with these technological issues, the actual wording is a bit Byzantine and hard to understand, but the upshot of this is that the new changes in the criminal procedure give federal agents massive powers to hack people without a warrant. Prior to this change, the FBI or other agencies couldn't just hack a bunch of computers around the world or the country all at once with one warrant. They had to go to each jurisdiction and get a warrant from that jurisdiction's judge. Rule 41 will change this and allow them to get one warrant from one judge anywhere and then use it to hack computers everywhere. Rule 41 will legalize this when, quote, the media or information is located has been concealed through technological means. So this means that if someone's using software like Tor, people use for entirely legitimate reasons to hide their identity online or other type of privacy type softwares. That's what they're talking about. The problem then is fairly clear. This means the FBI, with one warrant from a judge who, and I'm sure they'll pick one who doesn't really understand much of what's going on technologically, could then be used as the pretext to expand this investigation to many, many, many different devices, unlimited number of devices in the course of their investigation without any sort of additional warrant. So ultimately, it gives the government the right to hack anyone using a wide array of privacy protection software. And remember, this isn't just for terrorism or something like that, but any crime. There's another piece of Rule 41 that allows one judge to issue a warrant to allow the hacking of any computer that's part of a botnet. A botnet is a group of internet-connected computers that operate as a team, basically. These types of things can be used for a range of things, but often are used to spread malware and other types of hacks and attacks. However, malware can affect all sorts of computers, many of them clearly not actually involved in the operation or attack, i.e., the government could get into computers of all sorts of innocent, unknowing people with no real safeguards. Pretty obvious the potential for abuse there. The government, of course, claims that this is the only way they can deal with increasing sophistication of technological means of avoiding detection and the use of worldwide networks of computers to perform various hacks. However, Rule 41 addresses this with such a broad brush, basically anyone from journalists to people who simply don't want their data everywhere can have their privacy invaded without a warrant, as the FBI claims it's conducting some sort of investigation around some sort of crime, a situation that makes it fairly easy to create a pretext to search computers of, say, activists who the FBI claim may be involved in some sort of criminal activity. Further, the literally millions of people who are often infected by malware could also find their computers being snooped around on by FBI agents under the guise of trying to prevent some sort of hack. Given that many people, including judges, barely understand the technology, Rule 41 is clearly ripe for manipulation by the government to use one warrant to search millions of computers. Quite the back door. From 1972 to 1981, Chicago police commander John Burge and the men under him used torture to extract confessions from 110 black men. The men were beaten, suffocated with plastic bags, and had electrical shocks delivered to their genitals, as well as some being put in mock executions. Techniques, by the way, Burge picked up during his tour in Vietnam from fairly typical U.S. military practices at that time. Burge ended up only doing 3.5 years in jail because of the statute of limitations on many of these crimes ran out after Chicago police officials went above and beyond the call of duty to protect Burge and his torturing team, so all he could be convicted of was perjury. Chicago has spent roughly $120 million of taxpayer money in a combination of settlements to victims, fees for attorneys who defended Burge, pension payouts to some of the other torture cops, and the money spent investigating Burge's crimes once they decided to do that too. Now, in a major ruling, the way has been cleared for a deposition that may show just how deep the cover-up ran. Former mayor, Chicago State's attorney, and presidential chief of staff for Obama, Richard M. Daley, now may have to testify under oath as to what he knew while Chicago State's attorney and mayor about Burge's torture ring. Daley has been set to testify twice before, and the city saved him by settling the cases out of court. However, this time he may not only have to give testimony, but could be liable for damages. The lawsuit contends, as have many before, that Daley was fully aware of the torture ring and turned a blind eye purposefully. Hopefully, the testimony takes place, and hopefully it reveals even more about the sordid history of Chicago police. In addition to this torture ring, we know that Chicago PD has operated one of the most comprehensive and racist stop-and-frisk policies in the nation and operated a CIA-style black site to hold and intimidate suspects. CPD culture is clearly rotten to the core, and it's high time we shed more light on it. Potentially the most ridiculous turn of the Trump transition so far, word is being leaked that first daughter Ivanka Trump wants to be an advocate for climate change. Yep, climate change. This, of course, is just a ridiculous misdirection play, similar to her speech at the Republican National Convention. You remember that? It was all about women's rights and how Trump would fight for them and stand up for them. But then there was that inconvenient fact that his running mate tried to jail a woman for 20 years for having an abortion. Ivanka is the face of the Trump administration liberals can love and pretend that somehow she has some form of influence that means their worst nightmares won't come true. However, just a quick reminder here, Trump is assembling the most anti-climate change administration ever. His own chief of staff noted that he considers most climate science a, quote, bunch of bunk. His leader of the EPA transition effort is actually someone who does not believe climate change is real. The person who is leading his transition at the Interior Department is part of an organization that says they are committed to telling the, quote, forgotten moral case for fossil fuels, end quote. And most of the rumored heads of the Interior Department are at the highest levels of the pro-fracking movement. So, yeah. If you believe that Ivanka Trump advocating for women or the climate is actually meaningful, call me. I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are joined to continue this conversation today by Barrett Brown, who's an American journalist, essayist, and satirist. Barrett founded Project PM, a research collaboration in Wiki to facilitate analysis of a large number of hacked emails and other leaked information concerning the inner workings of the cyber military industrial complex. And in January 2015, Barrett was sentenced to 63 months in federal prison for so-called crimes. I would call them trumped up related to similar issues of things that were revealed on the internet about this said complex. And now we are happy to say he is out of prison to some degree and here with us today. Barrett, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. And so, you know, coming out at this time, it seems like this year to some degree was a vindication of sorts for some of the points you had made about the growing role for citizen journalists in the era of the internet, the age of the internet. And I think the DNC and Podesta leaks definitely sort of resurfaced that to some degree. I mean, obviously, mainstream media was reporting on it, but I mean, there were so many thousands of people just trolling through them, myself included, and surfacing all sorts of interesting, youthful information and stories. And so, I mean, I wonder that while in some sense, we're saying people are talking a lot about fake news and post-truth. If in some ways we're in the most truthful era we've been in quite some time because of a lot of this transparency, we know more about the inner workings of government and private business than perhaps ever before. But I don't know what you think about that.
I'm not able to really evaluate, you know, how accurate the average information that a citizen is perceives on a given basis as compared to like 20 years ago. The kind of anti-truth we're getting is different than the more centralized anti-truth we got in the 60s and 70s under Operation Mockingbird, CIA, its various press operations, Newsweek, Washington Post, Associated Press, that are, you know, became well-known in the late 70s after Bernstein reported on that, and then later on some releases. The propaganda is distributed. Propaganda is distributed, and so is the journalism. So it's a more complicated arena. The bottom line is that people do have better options. It's just a matter of finding them. Mm-hmm. And caring whether or not this is stuff that just reinforces your existing worldview or is actually accurate. Now, that's something you can lead a horse to water, but that's about it. My concern in a previous era, 2011, 2010, which is already, you know, light years away in many senses, my concerns were already pretty much information related. You're always going to have a degree of fundamental problems related to how we're governed, but governing that, fundamental to that, is always the information flow. And But the problems are different. The solutions, I think, are still the same. And that's the main thing I tend to talk about is what we can do to better that process, you know, via new methods of connecting, creating social networks for activism, for information distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I was involved in some of the more unconventional efforts, even the ones that weren't actually criminal. By anonymous, I was totally in favor of, for the same reason I'm in favor of the operation that those anti-war activists committed in the early 70s to expose the FBI's COINTELPRO, which is illegal. And they had to commit crimes to expose the FBI's crimes, and they were right to do so. We wouldn't have known about Martin Luther King receiving these bizarre communications from Edgar Hoover if it wasn't for that operation. Never has there been a major release or remedy of government psyops, government crimes, via its own channels. It's always been technically illegal processes that are brought to attention. So those are the kind of things we have to advocate if that's the only solution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good point. I'm actually glad you brought up Dr. King, because one of the things that I think a lot of activists and organizers in sort of, I guess, the coming era of Trump seem to be concerned about, and something we've talked a lot about on this show, is whether or not we may see sort of a new COINTELPRO type situation. Obviously, there's the Rule 41, which just recently passed, the whole Stingray issue, which we've dealt with quite a bit on this show. I mean, so do you think that people should are rightful to be fearful of that level of government surveillance and suppression moving forward here?
There should be more concern because it's a decentralized disinformation apparatus, as in the thing that revealed in the H.P. Gary hack that Anonymous did in 2011 that I was first involved with. Incidentally, those emails were re-released to the public by WikiLeaks a couple days in honor of my release, and now people should take a look at those, because those are the things that really were extremely alarming, even to those who already studied, you know, the history of these kinds of things. You have all these companies out here. We don't know how many there are. Drawing upon ex-military, ex-intelligence officials, ex-government officials, sometimes working for the government, sometimes working for other companies to do disinformation, to do propaganda, and to commit crimes in many cases, hacking of the same sort that anonymous participants were arrested for and raided by heavily armed agents 40 at a time back in late 2010, early 2011, when they did it against credit card companies in a protest. It didn't really do any damage. So there's a double standard that was re-revealed. There is a apparatus that was made evidence. And my real concern was that even after those things got attention in the mainstream media for about a month or so, to the extent that one of the CEOs had to resign, and Palantir's, Peter Thiel's Palantir firm, you know, was shown to have been involved in these things, and the president of Trump had to apologize, nothing really changed. Even the highest up employees who were involved in these very, very illegal operations, so illegal that Congress almost looked into them, They were back on the job with promotions just a few months later. The press is not able to perform its function without a great deal of help from bandits, frankly, outlaw activists, outlaw journalists. And that's an unfortunate situation. It's unfortunate for those of us who get punished for being involved in those things or for just reporting on them in some cases. You know, and that is remains my main concern, and I think it should be everyone's concern.
Yeah, well, and I'm glad you brought that up. And I mean, I wonder if you could say a little bit more about Peter Thiel and some of the role he's played in this. I mean, he's obviously, as you may know, got Trump's ear, it seems, and some of the other people from Palantir company that he founded have now gotten important roles inside of the transition team, which means often in the administration. And I've certainly been saying to people that should be somewhat concerning, but having looked a little more at him and the things he does, maybe you could speak to that.
Peter Thiel is one of the most dangerous men alive today. In part because, not just because he's totally amoral and has all these capabilities, but because he has managed to ingratiate himself with the previous administration by Palantir and now with the new incoming administration by Trump. No matter what the election results were going to be, Peter Thiel was going to continue to increase his viability to achieve whatever bizarre long-range plans he has, which are all the more dangerous because it's hard for people to really, I think, take them seriously. When you hear about, you know, longevity treatments of the sort that he and some of these other billionaires are looking into. These are things that are staples of sort of cyberpunk science fiction that, by virtue of that, sometimes enter the realm of fiction when they're first encountered, and that's kind of stay there in people's minds. But they are real possibilities. And let's say they're not. Let's just pretend that technology stays solid, that these very odd people in the technology sector will not semi-secretly advance more and more potentially dangerous technologies outside of the public eye. Let's pretend that. The capabilities that they have today that were exposed by the H.P. Gary emails, not just the initial revelations of the Team FEMA scandal, which did get some attention, but in the things that we kept looking into afterwards, like Romas Coin, persona management, those things are so dangerous if they proliferate just in terms of, you know, usage, not technology increasing, but just becoming more common. And we were not in a position in this country, we were already not able to maintain our institutions at a reasonable level of viability, even before these new techniques arose, whereby companies can go after their critics with the government's assistance using technologies that are very little understood, even within that intelligence sector, and in a distributed, privatized way where there's no way to put a stop to it. Even if, let's say we elected Jill Stein tomorrow, or we elected the Libertarian Party, and they said we're tired of the all CIA and the privatized intelligence sector, there's nothing they can do about it because there's 1,000 companies out there, even aside from large ones like Booz Allen Hamilton. All it takes is 5 or 6 pretty intelligent fellows, as we've seen in the internet age, to create something rather spectacular. And if they're working in that, if there's money to be made in that sector, if there's power to be gained in that sector, which there clearly is, they will seek to attain. And Peter Thiel is living proof of that. It's living proof of even when you're exposed using those technologies incorrectly in dangerous ways that undermine our democracy, you will not be punished for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break on that point. We're going to come back with more with Barrett Brown here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation here with Barrett Brown, who I'm sure many of you know as a journalist, essayist, and now many would say a political prisoner. I would certainly agree with that. He's now been released from federal prison, joining us here. And I want to just keep jumping right into it, Barrett. And I think we were just talking about Peter Thiel and the scariness of Peter Thiel. You know, another person that is popped up in the Trump administration is Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, who I saw an interesting story that her husband, when he had run for governor of Michigan, was for teaching intelligent design in the schools, which was, I guess, not that shocking, but somewhat shocking. And I also noted that you wrote a book about some of these people who've been promoting it. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, how is it possible that in the 21st century, we now have someone who is in the presidency with such an unbelievable non-scientific view? I mean, it just seems almost fantastical, really, to even say it.
We've seen something very similar happen between the first and 6 centuries AD, when a pretty advanced classical civilization was, you know, subject to disorder, sort of fell to what was still termed the Dark Ages in some circles, but at any rate was definitely a time of scientific and cultural viability. So, I mean, it would not be surprising to see what we've already seen, which is creationism, the bizarre mystical pursuits proliferate, you know, as civilization takes a wacky turn, which it sometimes does. And that's sort of a symptom of that. Intelligent design, you know, I would like to go back to those days in 2006, 2007, when intelligent design being taught in schools was really one of the big concerns that you know, you could have. Seems almost quaint now. I'm not familiar with a lot of his appointees. I've had the luxury the last few years of just being able to sort of tune all that out and read history books. So I'll have to get reacquainted with these new this new breed of you know, pseudo-technocrats that are coming in these days.
Well, you know, that's actually an interesting question. I'm glad you raised that. It makes me wonder, you know, how is it possible when you are in prison to even follow the election campaign? I mean, what sort of information are you guys allowed about sort of what's going on in politics day in, day out?
Well, we're not denied anything per se. I get in magazines in, The Economist, a few others across the ideological spectrum. People send me articles. They have TVs on. So CNN will be on. I'll get a sense of what other people are seeing at any rate. And then I have, you know, have contacts that kind of let me know about things that need to be looked at. You know, so I, you know, as a columnist, I actually tend to specialize in media criticism. I do try to follow these things. But it's nice not to have to. It's gotten so f***ed out there that, you know, it was nice to have a break.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, and I'm glad you brought up media criticism. You know, I mean, it was really unbelievable here on the outside. I mean, just about every pundit, as you may imagine, and as I'm sure you saw, just about all of them got it 100% wrong in terms of what was going to happen in the presidential election. I mean, just grievously wrong. I mean, the week before, people saying there's no chance Donald Trump will ever win. And I mean, I know that you've looked into a lot of sort of the punditocracy in America. I mean, what is it in this, I guess, realm of employment, if we want to call it that, that could cause such an unbelievable? I mean, it was like they didn't, no matter what. I mean, here he is, the candidate of the second major party or one of the two major parties, and they're saying there's no chance he could possibly win. I mean, how could these people all get it so wrong?
Well, what made me so nutty to begin with was when I started researching Thomas Friedman and Charles Krauthammer, reading their old columns and seeing how wrong they'd been about every single major event in American history in the last 15 years while still winning Pulitzers. That guy kind of freaked me out, and then how it's sort of across the board. Those are just the top examples there. The problem is that there's no reason for them to be right. There's no board of aldermen over there at the New York Times, Washington Post saying, hey, let's make sure that our guys aren't just putting out nonsense day after day. The fact is they are famous for being famous columnists, and you can't take that away from them. Once a pundit is made, he is rarely unmade. If he says something overtly racist, you know, that normally will do it. Maybe not anymore. I guess things have changed in that regard. But, you know, or he gets in some kind of sex scandal. But being wrong about the Iraq War, Afghanistan, Kosovo, as Krauthammer was, and then wrong about the surge, and then changing his mind about the surge when the surge did what he didn't think it was going to do, unless it didn't, or something, which was the Republican consolation prizes. Usually they said the surge would work, and then decided it worked, whether or not it did work. Krauthammer actually got that wrong, according to the Republican common sense position. So that really is... That's the key problem, is that there's no negative feedback in that industry. It's an important industry. That's our national consciousness, our nervous system, and it's broken. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a nation it's a combination of drugs, hallucinogens thrown in there somewhere, and we're running this massive global intelligence network. We're running an empire of unprecedented potential, even just like what we have now, the R&D potential, our potential to create a really frightening society is really extraordinary. And to have newspapers, you know, continue on as they are, even after this election, and not start to stop and think, are we doing something wrong? Is what we're doing harming America? I saw CNN the other day about the election. People could call in and vote on their CNN heroes. There was a headline. It was an Arizona grandmother, feels good to give kindness. I guess the story was she'd given kindness and she felt good about it. And that was a story on CNN like 5 days after the election. I mean, really just, and I don't see that system changing itself from within. I think it's going to take a lot of confrontation from without. I don't know what form that would take, but that's the reason why my emphasis is still on trying to figure out how we can develop new sort of activist social networks by which to, for instance, force attention to some of these issues. Get something like Thomas Friedman's past failures, force it into the Twitter sphere, et cetera, whatever you have now, the Snapchat to such an extent that it can't be ignored by the aldermen at the New York Times, for instance. And they either have to address it and say, hey, you're right, or ignore it and look bad. That's really all I can think of. Hopefully somebody, I just want people to start thinking in those terms so that we can really start addressing these issues, not just, it's not enough to know about them, it's not enough to complain about them or feel bad about them. There really has to be action at some point. And this is a society that, in which individuals perhaps don't feel compelled to take action pertaining to their own society, which is that's the central problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that you're entirely right. And I mean, it sort of brings me slightly to the next point I wanted to ask you about, which is, and it's also slightly related to the media. I mean, one thing we talk a lot about on this show is mass incarceration, prison conditions. And that, to me, is one of the most egregious areas where the media falls down. I mean, if I just compare your columns in The Intercept, where you're talking about your experiences in there, with every column in The New York Times for the past 5 years, you don't really get anything that's as sort of poignant about what's going on in prisons. And then here we are having this big conversation on the outside about mass incarceration. But there's very little way for people to get, not very little, but it, you know, you got to go the extra mile to really get informed about what's going on in there. And I think that really does put its thumb on the scale, is that you don't get a lot from the inside about what's going on.
Yeah, part of the problem is that the DOP and the various state agencies have, over the last 15, 20 years, have passed various resolutions and policies that make it harder for journalists to, you know, monitor prisons. That was actually one of the first articles that as a journalist was when TDC, after a rape of a female inmate by two guards, was made public. They met and passed new resolutions, and those resolutions banned Playboy magazines, and they made it harder for journalists not on deadline to interview inmates. So that gives you the mentality of the people in charge. The other problem is that the media is very event-oriented. It's action-oriented. If something happens, that's a headline. If something is just creeping up into a problem, it's much more drastic unless there's some specific tag that could be attached, you know, to an article. At least there's some event it's just not going to get the same kind of coverage. And that's a very unfortunate endemic part of just the day-to-day life of an editor and a journalist in a society such as ours. And that's really one of the reasons why these things get out of hand before they get detected by the nation at large. And then even when they do get detected, well, you know, there have been prison reform efforts, you know, of various sorts in the last several years. You know, those have come out, and there have been moves to reform, band-aids placed here and there. But then you get someone like Ted Cruz or Representative Cotton, and they're able to block it. And it makes sense for them to block it because they have a constituency. There are people in this nation, probably about half of them at least, who there's really no point in informing them on anything. You can provide people all the information you want. You know, there have been a lot of interesting studies the last few years showing it just simply reinforces their existing views in many cases. There are people like that. That's why eventually there needs to be another conversation about the nature of our democracy and the extent to which democracy is really a moral institution.
Interesting point. Very interesting point. And one other issue in terms of the things that we don't hear a lot about in terms of what's going on in there that I'd like to get you to shed some light on here. The Council of Europe in, I think, 2011 said that if you spend more than 15 days in solitary confinement, and if any country allows that, it should be considered a form of torture. Obviously, in America, we put people in there for much, much longer than that. You have been in the shoe, as they say, for longer than 15 days. So is the Council of Europe right, or are they maybe a little off base?
Some people are more susceptible than others to emotional torture. I've done about 6 months of my four-year bid in the shoe, 2 months at a time at the most. And people, you know, they learn to deal with it in many cases. They can't. The conditions vary. Certainly, it serves no productive purpose whatsoever. People are placed in there. You know, you'll hear things that say, oh, these are the worst of the worst. You know, in California, the gang affiliation means they can keep you in there indefinitely. And the way they prove gang affiliation can involve having certain tattoos, using words like señor or tío, which are, of course, common Spanish family designations, or having certain tattoos, having certain books. So it's obviously not a perfect process they have in place in the California penal system, which would be, you know, extraordinarily shocking. You know, it reaches a point where you really have to wonder if the whole institution, you know, if the institution that has allowed these things in the first place, an institution in which the president a few months ago had to intervene and say, we can't put children in solitary anymore. Mm. The fact that he had to do that, I think, is indicative of this. It's why, personally, I have no real interest in participating in a nation state, whether it be this one or any other. I don't want to have any kind of moral connection, political connection to a population that allows that kind of thing. That's why I think that the most important fact of the 21st century, the most, I think, perhaps hopeful fact, is that any individual can now collaborate with any other individual on the planet. They can start thinking in terms of creating new sorts of civil societies that transcend geography and commit people with shared values to perpetuate those values, you know, without having to, say, engaging obscurantism to get the votes of someone down the road in rural areas because you know that they hate this, and this, and maybe they're wrong, but you want to get this passed, and the only way to do that is do this. That's what Hillary Clinton did for 20 years, and the results, you know, there's nothing worse than a pragmatist who fails.
That's right.
That's why there has to be very, very fundamental conversations. And I think that what's happening now will probably spur those on a little bit more than, really quite a bit more than what would have happened if Clinton had won.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And I think now we're starting to see that in many different ways. I even saw on Think Progress, the Center for American Progress blog, something denouncing the Democrats, which shocked me as it's sort of like a pig flying. But now, be that as it may, you know, one other issue that I think is very relevant and that I think you're speaking to in terms of governmental power and really reexamining some of these basic terms like democracy is also how we look at the quote-unquote law and crime and so on and so forth. And I know you've written a lot about this. I mean, one of the things I always found so interesting when I moved to Southeast D.C. is how much, you know, quote unquote criminal activity takes place right in front of the police and is completely allowed by them. And it almost seems like it's not about the law per se, but just sort of these selective decisions to enforce what's written on paper to not, you know, change anything, but to remind people who's really in charge, which was just interesting to see that in real time in my life. But I wonder what you think about that general concept.
Yeah, I mean, we're a society of mammals and we've established governments around mammalian precepts, and that's, you're going to have imperfections as a result of that. That's to be expected. In some societies, those imperfections will be acceptable compared to the alternative. In some societies, you know, you're really going to have to start asking at what point does the rule of law become such a joke that you can point to it and say it no longer exists? You know, as in, does the rule of law really pertain if it's almost never applied, if it really comes down to bribery or favoritism or something else, as it does in many cases in this country and always has? So it's every individual has to decide for themselves, you know, when civil disobedience is necessary. I think the fact that you look at the federal laws and the state laws. You've had some convincing studies showing that if all the federal laws were enforced, every American can be shown to commit 3 felonies a day unknowingly, simply because there's so many regulations that just aren't understood. So you take drug laws, gambling, prostitution. If our laws were actually enforced across the board, we would live in a gulag state beyond anything in history. And that's another fundamental fact that needs to be taken a look at. I mean, what kind of society can only survive if we don't enforce our laws? Well, it's this society. And you know, it's either going to perpetuate sort of bouncing off the law in different directions based on the attention span of the public at large and based on the individual, you know, moral failings or otherwise of those, you know, working sort of in the deep state, the intelligence community and so forth, or it's going to be revised, you know, at some point in an open basis where these things get addressed, where we start looking into what's being done in our name, both overtly and covertly. The overt things are bad enough, you know, even what we know and what you know, goes on in front of our eyes, without even talking about, you know, what may be going on with the intelligence community. So, you know, I think the case is pretty strong that reasonable people who want to live in a free society, want to live in a decent society, need to, by all means, keep participating in the process. You know, work for your NGOs and donate to think tanks and charities and vote and write to your congressman and participate in that process. But also, please keep your eyes open for what else comes in the next few years in terms of these new civic networks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, certainly I will be looking at that. And the final piece I wanted to raise here is really a point of information for our listeners. So you have to pay something like $890,000 in restitution now that you've been released. Is that correct?
Yeah, so $800,000 to Strapper, which I was hacked by Jeremy Hammond and a few other people in order to obtain emails showing their criminal activities against, for instance, Bhopal activists who are trying to get money from Union Carbide for the people they killed with their plant in the 80s, or respond American activists paid at the government. I owe $100,000 to Stratfor because I called Stratfor and offered to redact any sensitive information that those hackers may have taken in case they had, for instance, informants in dictatorships abroad who might have gotten hurt from those things all being released at once, as they were originally planning to do. That was my crime in that regard. So I owe $100,000 to Stratfor for that particular crime. I owe $30,000 to Combined Systems, a weapons dealer that sells, among other things, military-grade tear gas to the Kingdom of Bahrain for use on pro-democracy protesters. And I owe another $30,000 or so to Puckett and Farage, a law firm which no longer exists, which, as we showed from the emails that Jeremy Hammond stole, was involved secretly as they were defending a suspected war criminal. They were involved with a certain congressman, another veteran, who was trying to intervene behind the scenes to make sure he didn't do any time for children he killed. So that's the total that I owe.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I will leave our listeners with this before we close. Go to freebarrettbrown.org and you can donate. You can help him out. He needs our help. Obviously, he's done a lot to help reveal some stuff that we're all working on, many of us who listen to this show. So, Barrett, thank you so much for joining the show. I really appreciate it, man, and wishing you all the best. We're going to take a break. Before we come back with more, here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in D.C., I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the interesting happenings in the political world, and we are very happy to be joined by Garland Nixon, who's the host of News Views with Garland Nixon that airs on WPFW-FM here in D.C. and online around the world. Also check him out on Facebook at Garland Nixon. He's very active there. Garland, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
So, well, I don't know if this is the number one news, but it's news that's out there. Nancy Pelosi handily winning her race for another term as the top Democrat ranking minority member. I mean, is this a sign that Democrats aren't really changing their spots post-election, or maybe is it not even really that significant? I mean, Pelosi is from one of the most liberal districts in the country. Your thoughts?
I don't think that is a big deal. I kind of expected Nancy Pelosi to win. I think the question is, you know, remains to be seen what happens at the DNC. You know, certainly, you know, if there is a platform that the part that's supposed to be the you know, guiding compass of the party, that kind of, it's kind of born in the DNC. And particularly when you're running for office, the DNC is decided, that's the organization that decides where all the money goes, who gets supported and who doesn't get supported when it comes time for elections. So I think it's all about the, right now it's all about the DNC. I don't think a lot of people who have been keeping up the politics for a long time expected someone as entrenched as Nancy Pelosi to be unseated. You know, someone like that, when you talk about the House and the Senate, I mean, these are very, very old institutions, and that certainly wasn't going to change overnight.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that I think is interesting, too, about this whole thing, and I wonder what you make about this, is the White House spinning against Keith Ellison, with essentially the argument being that, like, a black Muslim would not be a good representative, and that, you know, he had once said something positive about Louis Farrakhan and wasn't great on Israel. I mean, you, of all people to be launching from anonymous quotes this kind of attack, you'd think that Barack Obama, having been on the receiving end of some of that, you know, would have backed away.
Well, the other side of it is this, that, you know, Keith Ellison is, you know, the Obama administration, you know, they kind of faked left and went centrist right on a lot of things. But the fact of the matter is they're very much part of the establishment of the party. And Keith Ellison is the left, you know, the right, the right wing of the Democratic Party are the liberals and the left wing of the progressives. And Keith Ellison represents the progressive wing of the party, and the liberal wing of the party is trying to, you know, they don't want to be unseated by a progressive. And, you know, and by the, because if you have someone who's been a progressive and been as staunch a progressive for as long as Keith Ellison has been in charge of the in charge of the DNC, I mean, boy, that really spells problems for the liberals. Which are, which, you know, Barack Obama kind of pretended not to be, but the reality is he's one of the liberals. He's an establishment as there can be.
Well, I think that's 100% true, and I think 100% correct in terms of what's going on there. And the thing I just is interesting to me is just the number of litmus tests that are being thrown out there in context. Like, for example, I mean, Steve Bannon is the top White House advisor. So on, I mean, like, who cares that, that one time Keith Ellison said something about Louis Farrakhan, or who cares that he's been more outspoken on Palestine, which, by the way, many, many Democrats clearly want to see happen. And I think we saw that play out, inside of the primary election in and of itself. I mean, it's as if the Democrats are living in this fantasy world whereby Republicans have now just said, well, we're going to do whatever we want with whoever we want. But in the quote unquote liberal Democratic world, there's still all these litmus tests around acceptability. And I'm like, if you can have a white nationalist as the top White House advisor, I mean, most of this just seems completely ridiculous for them to be making this an issue of Ellison's past.
Well, the other part is most of the time, these types of litmus tests are ad hoc. You know, it's raising the bar. It's, this is a person that you don't want for ideological reasons. They're too far to the left for you. So you just keep coming up with reasons. Oh, well, he's a Muslim. Okay, we don't have a problem with that. How about maybe he's, you know, whatever. Oh, you know, every time you come up with a reason why Keith Ellison or whoever it is that they want, that the left would like to get in charge, if they don't want him, they're always going to come up with another reason constantly. You know, it'll be whatever. So they start off with identity politics or maybe something about Israel. If those don't get any ground, they'll just keep throwing stuff out there. You know, the way I always put it, like when some guy says to his girlfriend or something, hey, I want to come over Monday night. And she says, I got to wash my hair. He says, well, I'll give you a hand. And she says, got to vacuum. I'll help you vacuum. And it just keeps changing. That ain't the reason. And that's what that ain't the reason.
No, I hear
these
you.
These litmus tests are ad hoc litmus tests that are convenient, and they're hoping one of them will stick.
Yeah, they certainly
can't say the real reason. The real reason is he's too far to the left for them, and they can't come out and say that.
Right. No, I think that's 100% true. And it'll certainly be interesting. I think the one thing that I just had forgotten until this morning is they don't even vote on this until like March of 2017. So, I mean, there's still quite a bit of campaigning, and this has almost become like a race now, like some sort of election to see what's gonna happen here. So I think it's quite interesting. So shifting gears just a little bit here, Trump's cabinet, lots of folks talking about, well, he said he was going to drain the swamp and he isn't. I don't know, like, who was shocked by that. But maybe just start with this. General impressions, what are you thinking about what Trump's putting together here in terms of the cabinet?
Here's a couple things that don't surprise me. Donald Trump is an unabashed authoritarian, So when you look at national security, things of that nature, he's reaching for authoritarians. Well, you know, an authoritarian is going to reach for authoritarians. Number two, Donald Trump's a billionaire. Well, what do you know? He keeps reaching out. The guy is basically cloning himself. Mm. His cabinet is nothing but, you know, he wants a bunch of little Donald Trumps running around, and that's kind of what he's putting in there. And the other thing that's very, very obvious, and let me say it from both sides. There were a lot of people on the left when, you know, when many of us were told that Hillary Clinton has the most progressive platform, you know, the DNC has such a progressive platform, many of us believed that Hillary Clinton would say whatever she needed to say about the platform, and then when she got in, she would do what she wanted to do. And the same for Donald Trump. Well, one thing is obvious. All that economic populism and standing up to Wall Street stuff was Donald Trump. I mean, he didn't for a day try to pretend like he meant a word of anything that he said.
Right.
He's exactly the opposite. He's coming off as a far right wing, you know, dogmatic, doctrinaire, authoritarian conservative, which I think will be really bad for the Republican Party in both the short and the long run. We shall see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and I think that certainly that is the big question of his administration with some of these people coming out. I mean, you got the foreclosure king, you got the bankruptcy king, you got someone who made their fortune off of a pyramid scheme, all sorts of people in there. I mean, I also wonder what you make of this Mitt Romney thing. I mean, it's somewhat unbelievable to me, not that he came around to Trump, but I mean, his statement, which was so effusively positive. I mean, maybe is it really just a sign of how powerful the institution of president is that someone like Romney, who had gone way above beyond the call of duty to be against Trump, has now bended the knee, you know, in such an obsequious way?
It's not shocking for two reasons, not the least of which being, let's not fool ourselves. Mitt Romney is a very, very rich man, and Donald Trump is a very, very rich man. And when it comes down to it, their loyalty is to their class first. Donald Trump likes Mitt Romney considerably like more than he likes you and me.
Mm.
And the reverse is true. So when you start to looking at this thing by class, Donald Trump, you know, funny thing or not, I believe it or not, I heard a wealthy conservative during the primaries refer to Donald Trump as a traitor to his class. Well, one thing is obvious about Donald Trump and Mitt Romney both. They're not a traitor to their class. They're both wealthy men. They're both representing wealthy people. You know, they go to the same country clubs, they hang out, they, you know, hobnob and drink champagne with the billionaires. So is it really so surprising that when the dust settles, they're back hobnobbing with each other and they're all their billionaire buddies together?
Mm.
We were the ones who were kind of suckered into believing that these billionaires had enmity between them. They never had any enmity between them. They just, you know, they all talked the talk and played the game to pretend that they had their little fights. Yeah, that stuff was set up,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
No, I think you're certainly right. And I think the other setup I see coming, but, you know, perhaps you think differently, although I doubt you do. It seems pretty obvious to me. This whole Ivanka Trump thing, she said, oh, I'm all about women's issues. Now she wants to speak out on climate change. I mean, it's clearly completely fake given how, the vice president is a dude who jailed a woman for having an abortion. And the guy in charge of the EPA transition doesn't believe in climate change, but whatever. I'm curious what you think about that unbelievable bait and switch, but it just makes me think again. I mean, are the Republicans really very far out ahead in terms of the Democrats strategically? I mean, it just seems as if they have all these ways, the Trump people, of you never quite know where they're going or what they're going to do, and there's always a little ambiguity, and that clearly helps them. And it just seems like they strategically are just one, you know, rung ahead of the Democrats for sure.
Well, I think at some point we're going to have to change the way we talk. Let's not forget, the Republican Party got the Republican Party lost. The Republican Party got wiped out, got crushed in the primaries. Donald Trump didn't get elected because he was an establishment Republican. He got elected because he wasn't one.
Mm.
Now, excuse me, but you know, he played like he wasn't one on TV. But at any rate, so now that Donald Trump has completely lied to and misled his voters into voting for him, and he's doing an about face, the question is how long, 6 months to a year, before they recognize they've been completely had and they're unhappy about that.
Mm.
Because he's, you know, his voters, they hated the mainstream establishment Republicans. Now that Donald Trump has got elected, he has completely embraced the people that they despise, the people that they elected him because they despise those people. So the question is, how long will it be before the people who put him in here because they despise the establishment Republicans come to the realization that they've been had and start basically viewing him as one of them? That remains to be seen, I'd say, within a year. But the Republican Party, they fooled themselves into thinking that they're in a good position.
Mm.
And they are not in a good position because they've got Donald Trump in and they've got a bunch of people that are expecting something. You know, I've read things where some of these people are like, okay, we're all ready for the jobs to come back. And if you think a bunch of billionaires are going to bring jobs back, you know, they got a lot to learn. So it's just a matter of time before they realize they've been had. And then there's going to be heck to pay again for the Republican Party. So the question is, does the Democratic Party get itself together? You know, it doesn't seem to be right now. I think the proof is in the DNC pudding, what happens there. But I think the Republicans haven't. They crashed and burned, but it appears that they haven't crashed and burned because a person with the name Republican won.
A little self-delusion there never hurts, perhaps, for the people who are there. Will hurt them later. Other big issue is this, you know, recount situation, whichever going on in that, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, or Wisconsin and Michigan now, perhaps later Pennsylvania. What do you make about this recount and Jill Stein's efforts here?
You know, that's a good question. I met Jill Stein. I like her. Far be it for me to say anything bad about Jill Stein. But whether intentionally or not, effectively, she's a proxy for Hillary Clinton, you know, basically the states that would be the most advantageous for recounts for Hillary, for the Clinton campaign. And then all of a sudden, all of these mysterious millions of dollars, you know, she gets like $3.5 million in the last 30 years. And then she gets like $7 million in 30 minutes.
Right.
So it's fairly obvious that money didn't come $5 at a time from Green Party donations.
Mm.
But at any rate, you know, it is kind of dangerous. It is dangerous because can you imagine if they did some recount and suddenly decided, well, you know, we changed our mind, Hillary won.
Mm.
You would have a destabilization of democracy. Whether we like Trump or not, I think you would destabilize democracy. Now, even worse, imagine if the electors from the states that Donald Trump won decided they were going to jump over to Hillary, like some Hillary people would love to have.
Mm.
So what you have now, you would have now is basically states could just decide, regardless of whether or not a candidate won, the states could just decide, we're all going to go for the other candidate. And so you really wouldn't have an election anymore. No Democrat would ever get the electors anywhere south of, like, Maryland. You know, from Virginia and south, a Democrat could win North Carolina, Virginia, and Georgia and Texas, and they wouldn't get into the electors because they just jumped for the Republican.
Mm. Yeah,
so there's
some
kind of dangerous things going on here.
No, I think it's a good point. And the other thing I just think about is, I don't want to say it's a canard, because if they find something was wrong, then it wasn't a canard. But it seemed to me that the bigger issue from jump was, and potentially the one more explosive legally, is voter suppression. And this will do nothing to touch on that.
Exactly. Yeah, because now here we've got Jill Stein. How convenient is this for Hillary? You know, there's some foreign entity, and we know who that is, allegedly,
mm-hmm.
right? This foreign entity, that is pure Clintonism. And the thing that here's what really bothers me about it the most, and that is that what's going on here is that the Democratic leadership, the elite, you know, rulership of the Democratic Party cannot take accountability for their actions. They refuse to take responsibility for what they did and why they lost. And so it's got to be somebody else's fault. And Jill Stein is enabling them. So how can the party rebuild if they won't take responsibility for the fact that when they decided, well, for every Democrat we lose, meaning a progressive, we'll gain two Republicans. That's what they said. For every Democrat we lose, we'll pick up two moderate Republicans, which didn't work because they lost both the Democrat and the moderate Republicans.
Right.
So they kind of backfired. They lost all three. But as long as they're running around blaming it on, quote, foreign entities, they're never going to be able to rebuild the party because when people make that argument with me, well, there was this and Comey and the Russians, et cetera, and I say, well, if that's the case, then you might as well just run Hillary and Tim Kaine again in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
If it was such a brilliant idea and you didn't do anything wrong, then you might as well do it again.
Well, and you know what's to me so hilarious about the whole thing is they all thought they were being so smart when they, as we know from WikiLeaks, came out and were like, oh, we're going to trick the Republicans into putting someone in there like Trump who could never be elected. I mean, wow. I don't know. I would be – I would probably never show my face again in public if I was Robbie Mook. I don't know about you.
Yeah. You know, when you looked at these things, well, you know, I've been on the show for a while. And, you know, Nostradamus, I'm not, but it was so obvious in front of my face. I kept saying, these people are going to lose. How obvious could it be? they executed a flawless strategy to lose to Donald Trump. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I remember the guy in Iowa, these nuts. Hillary would have lost to him. He ran so bad, she'd have lost to that guy. And he was like a teenager. He wasn't even 35, but he would have probably beat Hillary on a write-in vote.
You're definitely right about that. You're definitely right about that. We're going to have to leave it there for today. Garland Nixon, News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW. Check him out on Facebook, Garland Nixon on Facebook. Very active there as well with great commentary that you can hear more of. That's going to do it for today's show. And you were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.